Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Joining NATO is good for Finland. It is good for Nordic security, and it's good for NATO as a whole.
History was made this week in Brussels, as the flag of Finland was raised at NATO headquarters on Tuesday.
From today, 31 flags will fly together, a symbol of our unity and our solidarity.
With receipt of this instrument of accession, we can now declare that Finland is the 31st member of the North Atlantic Treaty. Congratulations.
That's NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg and US Secretary of State Antony Blinken welcoming Finland into the alliance. But back home, elections in Finland last Sunday have shaken up its political landscape. Finnish Prime Minister Sanna Marin's Social Democrat Party was narrowly beaten into third place behind the centre-right National Coalition Party and the far-right Finns Party, a political blow for the European left.
Finnish people, they want change. And that's why Kokoomus is the biggest party in Finland and in the parliament now.
Marin is one of the best-known EU leaders internationally, credited, among other things, with leading Finland's dramatic pivot towards NATO, which culminated in this week's ceremony. But domestically, she failed to sell her left-leaning economic policies. And now, her political future is uncertain. Also at NATO headquarters this week,
I'm glad to welcome all of you to this meeting of the NATO-Ukraine Commission.
Foreign Affairs Ministers gathered for a two-day meeting focused on Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine. Later in this episode, you'll hear from Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba about what his country needs from the military alliance and whether he's worried about war fatigue in the West.
If someone in Europe or beyond Europe gets tired of the war, they will welcome the war at their doorstep. It's very simple.
But while there has been plenty happening in Brussels this week, many in Europe are watching what's happening further afield in China, where French President Emmanuel Macron and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen are meeting with President Xi Jinping as they try to navigate the diplomatic minefield that is Europe's policy on China. Will they return to Europe with a much-needed diplomatic triumph? I'm Suzanne Lynch, Politico's Chief Brussels Correspondent. And this week on EU Confidential, we'll bring you the inside scoop on Europe's efforts to prevent China from getting even cozier with Russian President Vladimir Putin, while at the same time keeping economic lines open. We'll be speaking to Stuart Lau, our EU-China correspondent, in just a moment, and Clea Colcott, our senior France correspondent, who is currently covering the visit in China. But first, let's check in with Politico's editor-in-chief, Jamil Anderlini. He's in Beijing with French President Emmanuel Macron. So Jamil, you know China very well. You've spent most of your career in Asia. What can you tell us about this trip and what Emmanuel Macron is trying to achieve?
Thank you, Suzanne. I'm standing right now in the Great Hall of the People in just off Tiananmen Square in the center of Beijing, and I'm waiting for President Macron and President Xi Jinping to come in and give a press conference with Chinese characteristics, which means no questions and prepared speeches and nothing else. So The trip is, as you would expect, has been really arranged down to the finest detail. In many ways, the whole trip is meant to be symbolic, it feels. You know, obviously, the French side and President Macron is really managing expectations, pointing out that it's better to be talking than not talking, and not really sort of trailing any major agreements on things like Ukraine. I had a senior French official say to me, we don't expect China to switch sides and abandon Russia, but of course we want to help to present the Ukraine position as well and what Europe thinks about it. So I think the overall, the tone of the trip is we, you know, Europe should keep talking to China, even in difficult times, that there's a lot of trade that can still be done, that investment is something that Europe wants to do more of in China, or France wants to do more of in China. And the overall tone is sort of the symbolism of continuing to talk. And I think France sees itself, and Macron especially, sees itself as having a special role. Maybe not the sort of grand superpower it once was, but a second-rate power that is able to, I'm sure they wouldn't say this, but, you know, reality is a second-tier power that is able to maybe tread a slightly different line or quite different line from the United States and be more friendly to China than the US is and other US allies.
And what about Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, Jamil, her presence? She's there also on this trip.
So alongside Emmanuel Macron's trip, he's made a special point of including Ursula von der Leyen, President of the European Commission. And that's very intentional to show European unity, in contrast to German Chancellor Scholz, who came last November to China, but didn't come with anyone from the European Union. So there's a bit of messaging here about the unity of Europe and France's commitment to that European unity. The reality is that Ursula von der Leyen, just before she came to China, gave a very tough speech.
We have to be frank on this point. How China continues to interact with Putin's war will be a determining factor for EU-China relations going forward.
And she has a separate program, apart from a trilateral meeting with Xi Jinping and Macron, a short trilateral meeting. And it's really, apart from that, everything has been separate. And there's some symbolism there too, because Macron is treading a much softer, I would say, and more genial line with China. And Ursula von der Leyen is much tougher. And her position publicly is closer to that of the United States.
Thanks so much, Jamil, for that, for calling in all the way from Beijing.
Thanks, Suzanne.
Now, let's turn to our EU-China correspondent, Stuart Lau, here in Brussels, and also Clea Callcutt, who's also in Beijing. They're going to bring us up to speed on the outcome of these meetings. Stuart, as we talk, Ursula von der Leyen has recently just finished her press conference following her own meetings with President Xi and Macron. What do you think are the main points from that presser that has just finished there?
Yeah, Suzanne, I think the part about Ukraine is definitely very interesting. So von der Leyen, together with Macron, for that matter, you know, they've been trying to push Xi Jinping to commit to further pledges on Ukraine. So what's really interesting is hearing von der Leyen saying in the press conference that when she raised the point about the fact that Xi Jinping should be having a call with the Ukrainian president Zelensky, Xi Jinping actually got back to her to say that, well, if it's the right time and the right conditions, I'm very happy to do so.
So it was interesting to hear that President Xi reiterated his willingness to speak when conditions and time are right. I think this is a positive element.
That's definitely what she calls a very promising sign as well. So the other really interesting matter that she raised was Taiwan, because as we know, you know, the Taiwanese president is currently in the United States. There's a lot of concerns about escalations around the Taiwan Strait.
A meeting that angers China. U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy met on Wednesday with Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen during a stopover in California. The meeting took place despite repeated threats of retaliation by Beijing. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has urged Beijing not to use this meeting to take actions that would increase tension in Taiwan.
So she made it very clear to Xi Jinping, according to her, that, you know, there's a clear interest for the EU to preserve peace and status quo in Taiwan Strait.
We all agree that stability in the Taiwan Strait is of paramount importance. We have a very clear
Interesting is also what's not said in the meeting with Xi Jinping and also Premier Li Qiang. Apparently, the subject of CIA, the Comprehensive Investment Agreement, didn't come up, which is a bit of a surprise to the business lobby groups, but also a lot of, you know, trade policymakers in Europe, because, you know, they were actually expecting Beijing to put pressure on the EU to, you know, sort of revive the negotiations or revive the ratifications. But apparently the subject didn't come up.
And actually, Stuart, this brings us nicely into our usual package we do each week on the podcast, Decoding Brussels Speak. Explain to us about CAI. What is it?
CAI, CAI stands for the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment. So it was concluded back in 2020, when Angela Merkel's Germany was the presidency of the Council of the European Union. So it was supposed to bring more European businesses to operate on fairer terms in China, because, as you know, China is still a pretty closed kind of market for a lot of European businesses, overseas businesses. So Europe was trying to undo part of that. So it was concluded in 2020, but then there were mutual sanctions between China and the EU, started by the EU sanctions on Xinjiang officials involved in human rights violations against the Uyghur population. And then China retaliated by sanctioning some European Parliament members. And so the European Parliament decided to freeze it. So in the speech that was just mentioned by Jamil, she also talked about CAI. She said, you know, the CAI, the investment agreement, would have to be reassessed because of all the changes that we have seen over the last 3 years.
Yeah. Okay. So interesting she said CAI, no mention of CAI in her discussion with Xi on Thursday. Claire, how's it going over there in Beijing? I mean, how is President Macron's arrival being treated, being covered, and for that matter, Ursula von der Leyen's too?
Well, I mean, I think it's safe to say that it's a very warm welcome from the Chinese when it comes to Emmanuel Macron, you know, red carpet welcome. We saw today a stupendous, very impressive welcome ceremony with Xi Jinping and Macron's motorcade arriving. There was some tapping on the shoulders and then national anthems, and there was no hitch in all of this. It was a very tight choreography. And one MP I spoke to afterwards says it was exactly the same thing last time we came, but she felt more warmth this time. Xi Jinping smiled to the French politicians. And I think that the stance that Macron is taking coming here, which is much more a softer tone and not quite so much muscle flexing as a von der Leyen, is sort of paying off in this manner, in that he's getting this great reception.
Interesting, because in a way, this kind of plays into the Chinese idea that they're casting themselves as a kind of playing a big role in international peace. Thursday in Beijing, they're also hosting Saudi and Iranian officials, trying to keep open the dialogue there. So you can understand why, I suppose, they're welcoming Macron in this way. But it doesn't seem to be the same for von der Leyen. That's a lot more low-key from what it seems.
No, exactly. Von der Leyen is not included in most of the events of Macron's trip. And we heard yesterday Macron even distancing himself from von der Leyen's speech last week. And he said that the stance that counts on China is the one of the European Council, which is obviously not the one that she represents as the head of the European Commission. So there was a slight sort of step back. I mean, obviously, he's coming with her and he wanted her to be there. So whether this is also sort of diplomatic playing by showing a tougher and a softer approach to the Chinese, possibly so. But it's true that when you look at the coverage in the Chinese media, where von der Leyen has been vilified and is seen as being very much a hawk close to the US, it doesn't, in appearance, there doesn't seem to be that united front that Emmanuel Macron was saying it would be going into this trip.
I mean, how do you read it, Stuart? Is this more strategic on the EU's part, that, you know, it's a good cop, bad cop kind of strategy, that von der Leyen is going in with this kind of tougher talk and Macron is all about dialogue and openness? Or what do you read from this?
I mean, a good cop, bad cop strategy would be a good one if it actually delivers something, right? But looking at what if, you know, the kind of deliverables that we have seen after a whole day of diplomatic events, we have not seen a lot of concrete deliverables, any pledges from the Chinese side on, you know, righting the trade imbalances, for example, which is, you know, such a big call from von der Leyen. Also on Ukraine, apart from, you know, a vague promise of talking to Zelensky at the right time, there's not a lot of concrete results coming from the meetings today. So we'll have to see. I mean, of course, you know, the French side are also, you know, pushing for a lot of trade deals, a lot of deals with the Chinese businesses. So in that lens, of course, you know, is a good boost for Macron. But as far as his European dream is concerned, I mean, we're not actually seeing China talking a lot about Europe, if you like. I mean, so much of the focus going back to the Chinese media is actually on France. Of course, you know, Macron is coming on a state visit, but von der Leyen is not.
Yeah, interesting. And I suppose this whole strategy about Ukraine, you know, the proof is going to be on the in the pudding there. Is China going to play a responsible role? Is it going to be involved in some kind of peace negotiations? I mean, we've heard before, you know, Macron, we've seen this before, Macron reaching out to Putin, for example, and that didn't exactly yield much. Clea, what's your final thoughts on what Macron really wants to get out of this trip?
Going into the trip, he started playing down expectations, saying that he was approaching all of this with great modesty, humility, and that, you know, we have to think about the long game and that things aren't going to shift straight away. Obviously, I think you can read in that some disappointments that more deliverables weren't achieved, though for many months they have been negotiating with the Chinese over this trip, and I think they probably wanted more. I mean, what he wants to come out of it with is this sort of sense, and I think Jamil mentioned it, of being a sort of go-between, of being somebody who, while not one of the big superpowers, may be able to push through some messages or stop what he thinks will be an escalation between the US and China, and that he could play a role in that. Obviously, this is something that I think he believes possibly that this is the role that France has played in the past and should play. Obviously, it also helps from his domestic view that at the moment he's facing a lot of protests in the streets over his pension reforms, and it does help to show that on the international scene, he's doing things, he's helping, you know, build world peace. I mean, these are all things that he's hoping and his team are hoping will trickle down back home.
Clea, Stuart, thanks so much for that analysis. And Clea, best of luck for the rest of the trip in China.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And make sure you sign up for our newly revamped transatlantic newsletter, China Watcher, co-authored by Stuart and our Washington colleague, Phelim Kine. We'll include a link to that in our show notes. Coming up, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba. He's in Brussels this week to speak directly with NATO allies, and he also shares his view on whether China can play a role in ending Russia's war in Ukraine. Stay with us.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Dmytro Kuleba has served in Ukraine's diplomatic service for the bulk of a decade and as foreign minister since March 2020. But
Russia's war in Ukraine has propelled him into the international spotlight. This week, he finds himself in Brussels speaking to NATO allies about the alliance's role in the fate of his country and Ukraine's ambitions to join. Just to start, what are you hoping for from a meeting of NATO foreign ministers here in Brussels?
Everything that contributes to Ukraine's victory in the war against Russia. Every day we wake up, and even before having coffee, we already begin working on what else can help us win in the war. And I came to Brussels to this meeting of the NATO-Ukraine Commission, which actually hasn't taken place since 2017. So the very fact of holding this meeting is politically symbolic. But we have very specific ideas. Some of them are, as NATO likes to say, practical. But I believe that the most practical thing is actually to get Ukraine on board. And therefore, a good part of my address to NATO and my conversations with NATO foreign ministers will be about facilitating Ukraine's accession to NATO.
What do you see as the stumbling blocks for that? Are there any particular countries, or what do you need to do, do you think, to overcome some skepticism about Ukraine's membership?
Outdated perceptions and prejudices.
And in particular, what? Do you think allies are nervous, are scared, that it's fearful for them that Ukraine, that it could be seen as provocative?
Well, we've been, you know, through so many arguments against Ukraine joining NATO since 2008, the Bucharest summit, which for the first time recognized that one day Ukraine will be a member of NATO. So ever since then, NATO regularly, basically on an annual basis, reiterates the open door policy for Ukraine. But the truth is that we're not getting any closer to that open door. And it's even worse, you know, when you know that the door is closed, it's one thing, but when you see it open, but someone is keeping you at the distance of the handshake from that door, that is even worse. But I mean, speaking rationally, as the political discourse in the West is built on rational arguments, right? So there was the argument that the issue of NATO membership divides Ukraine. No, it's not. 82% of Ukrainians want Ukraine to be a member of NATO. There was an argument that NATO should not expand further to have a direct border with Russia. Finland, I'm happy for my friends from Finland who are becoming NATO members and who share more than 1,000 kilometers of border with Russia. So NATO is not afraid of having a joint border in the north, but somehow is afraid of having a joint border in the south. And the third argument is don't divide NATO on Ukraine's membership. Well, this is exactly the argument that we heard a year ago in the European Union in the course of discussions on granting Ukraine the EU candidacy status. But once this status was granted, this was actually the moment of unity and strength for the European Union, and everyone is enjoying it. So that's why I'm saying that these concepts of why Ukraine should be promised membership but should not be given membership is outdated. It doesn't meet reality check, and we will have a very honest conversation with partners about it.
In terms of specifics, what are you looking for in terms of your allies, what they can provide in terms of weaponry? What do you need?
Well, first, I think it's mutually beneficial for NATO to support Ukraine, because Ukraine is fighting a war against our common enemy, the enemy who wants to destroy the post-Second World War order that was established here, in particular through the creation of NATO. And the fact that NATO remained politically sexy, political and security-wise sexy over the decades, and new members want to join it, speaks for the success of this undertaking. But as much as Ukraine benefits from the support provided by allies, Ukraine itself first keeps the war, as bad as it may sound, but it keeps the war in its own territory, and we are not asking foreign boots on the ground. We are one of the very few nations in the world who have not asked foreign troops to be deployed to our land. We are ready to fight this war on ourselves because we know what we are fighting for our land and for our identity. But NATO learns a lot from this war. and therefore strengthens its own defense capabilities. So it is a mutually, and we are grateful for every piece of support that we receive, and I say that with utmost sincerity, but this is a mutually beneficial partnership which makes us natural allies.
There's a lot of talk at the moment about an offensive, a counteroffensive by Ukraine. What do you need to try and move forward with that action?
We need to speed up deliveries of everything that has already been pledged since literally last December. That is happening, and big part of my conversations here in Brussels will be about speeding up some very specific deliveries, like armored vehicles, artillery ammunition, tanks in particular. And the second part of the preparation is actually to get new pledges done, because and to ensure sustainability of supplies, because this war, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And while, for example, you have 100 shells in your stock, right, and you know that you can count on them for the counteroffensive, but you have to know how many shells you will be you will have in the stock in 2 or 3 months' time. The result of war is about a lot of mass, and you have to do all of these calculations. And while preparing for the counteroffensive to be launched tomorrow, you have to simultaneously think and talk and solve the problems related to what you will need after tomorrow.
Are you worried a bit about fatigue on the part of the West, war fatigue?
If someone in Europe or beyond Europe gets tired of the war, they will welcome the war at their doorstep. It's very simple.
Yeah.
Again, it doesn't matter how high the price of supporting Ukraine is, which is not as high as the critics actually claim it to be. The price of fighting the war yourself will be much more higher. And the costs, all kind of costs, will skyrocket. So I wouldn't be, you know, so many people did not believe that the large-scale invasion of Ukraine by Russia is possible. The same people now don't believe that the war between Russia and Western countries is impossible. You know, I wouldn't put all the stakes, all the eggs into that basket.
What about the role of China? There is a lot of concern, particularly in the US, that China could help Russia militarily. What's your view on the role China plays in the Russian invasion?
I once read this famous saying that the West thinks in decades and the China thinks in centuries. China is not in a rush. While the West is in a rush to help Ukraine, which we deeply appreciate, China doesn't seem to be in a rush to make its kind of final stance on the war. I think the more this war will evolve and the clearer the balance on the battleground, both military battleground but also the diplomatic battleground will become, the more it will prompt China to lean towards one side or another. Of course, their official policy will be to stay above the fight. But life will dictate circumstances. I don't have a feeling that they made their choice.
Do you think they have a role in some kind of a peace agreement?
You know, no country in the world wants peace more than Ukraine. That's the starting point. But to do peace talks, you need two sides. And there is not a single evidence coming out of Russia that they want peace. They imposed this war on all of us. We took up the challenge. We're fighting against them. And we said it very clearly, and I said it to my Chinese counterpart, foreign minister in particular, that, guys, you know, there is one thing that really is the common foundation for your foreign policy and our foreign policy. It's the principle of territorial integrity. So anything you can do to restore peace that will respect full territorial integrity of Ukraine within its internationally recognized borders, you are welcome. Every peace concept that is based on a different principle will be rejected for natural reasons. So as of now, we didn't get a clear response to that.
I mean, so that includes Crimea as well. The Crimea be part of Ukraine.
don't get me personal, but people who work with me know very well that every time a journalist asks me, including Crimea or whether it includes Crimea, I make a disclaimer that I think it's a very bad idea to make this emphasis on including Crimea every time, because basically we are reinforcing the Russian narrative that Crimea is something special, while it is not. There is no difference between Kyiv, Sebastopol, Donetsk, Lugansk. There is simply no difference between that. All of that is Ukrainian territory. And when I say full respect of Ukraine's territorial integrity, that includes it all.
And that's all the time we have for today. We're going to be off next week, but we'll be back in your feed on April 20th. So be sure to follow or subscribe to EU Confidential wherever you're listening to ensure you never miss an episode. And do keep your ideas and feedback coming. You can email us at podcast@politico.eu. This week's episode was produced and edited by our executive producer for audio, Christina Gonzalez, and Zoe Bass. I'm Suzanne Lynch in Brussels. Thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.